People often say that you can't place a dollar value on a human life, but in fact, there is a large underground economy that does just that. If you know where to look and are willing to pay, you can acquire nearly anything from human hair to a kidney or a womb and even bones, all of it a multi-billion dollar industry that usually operates on the fringes of legality. Scott Carney's investigation of human organ trafficking is called The Red Market. It's published by William Morrow, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show today for our backstory segment. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Leonard. Great to be back.
How much is the global trade in human body parts estimated to be in dollars? And isn't most of it made in dollars?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish there was a good answer for it. But frankly, there isn't, especially when you talk about the black market and you're looking at basically criminal networks. And if we include everything from blood sales to adoption to kidneys to bones and every other body part, it's, you know, even clinical trials, we're talking tens of billions of dollars.
How far back in history have human body parts been harvested for various uses? I mean, there was a long history of grave robbing in the 19th century, wasn't there, for medical mm-hmm. purposes?
Sure, and yeah, if we want to talk about grave robbing and the word skullduggery, which is literally going into a graveyard and digging up a cadaver so that you can use it for basically medical research, you know, training young doctors, that started in probably the 1700s, more or less. The first anatomical sketches were by Leonardo da Vinci in the 1500s. So, you know, it goes back to then. But if we really want to expand the notion a little further, you can go back into ancient Egypt where, you know, Mary Roach wrote about, in her book Stiff, wrote about mummified man, which was a honeyed human cadaver that people would eat as medicine in ancient Egypt. So this is a very, very old trade.
But the industry has grown dramatically over the past few decades. Why now?
Well, if we look at the way the economics and the science have progressed, you know, since the beginning of the 1900s, we've really gotten better at, you know, swapping out body parts and, you know, advancing medicine just right across the scheme. So, you know, naturally, as our science gets better, so does the demand for those human body parts. You know, if you look at blood transfusions, there weren't really any in the 1800s. In the 1900s, it's just, you know, gone up like a logarithmic curve.
Is most of the activity on the red market legal? Illegal? Quasi-legal?
Most of it is legal. Even some of the horribly unethical stuff is technically legal, such as harvesting organs from executed Chinese prisoners. That is technically legal in China, therefore legal in general, but it's very questionable. The WHO estimates that if we're talking about kidneys, about 10% of transplants are illegal and done on the black market, which means people being kidnapped for their organs, people being coerced into selling their organs and that sort of thing. 90%, though, is, you know, pretty much okay. So what I'm looking at in the book, though, is really what happens when these medical systems go wrong.
We recently talked to Daniel Asa Rose about his book, in which he tells the story of his cousin Larry's search for a kidney in China. And he's never 100% sure where that kidney actually came from. But Larry went there because he was desperate. He couldn't get a kidney here.
Well, I think Daniel did write in the book that he knew exactly where the organ came from. They even make jokes in one of his chapters that that someone's execution date's just around the corner. I actually had a coffee with him about a year ago, and he was actually pretty worried because he didn't actually spend too much time thinking about where these organs came from. And, you know, it's very likely, at least, that the organ came from an executed political prisoner in China.
So is it fair to say that in 2011, bodies and body parts are sold as just another commodity like corn or copper? And is this... because we mentioned Daniel going to China. Has this also been the result of globalization?
Well, so to answer your first question, it's not quite like corn or copper because there's no a large exchange, right? You can't find a market rate for a kidney. It's all about individual negotiations between individual people. Buying a kidney on the black market is a lot like buying a used car. You know, you sort of come to the table empty-handed, and it's sort of an individual negotiation. Your second question was, has globalization made this bigger? And absolutely. Now, you know, if you look at the organ transplant list in the United States, it's around 100,000 people waiting for a kidney. Now, that can take you up to 10 years to get a kidney, sometimes significantly less, but, you know, 10 years is the sort of the longer prognosis for that. You could go to China and in 2 weeks have a donor organized for you at about half the price of the U.S. transplant.
But most of the your writing focuses on India. That's because you lived there for a decade?
I lived in India for about 6 years, since 1998. My book focuses quite significantly on India because the sort of body markets are quite extensive there. But the book also takes this holistic view, and I don't want people to think that I'm just sort of sticking a finger at India and saying you're the worst place in the world for this. It's not at all. These sorts of transactions happen on every continent on the earth, and you know, from China to Brazil to South Africa, and in North America, Canada, Mexico, you name it, it's going on.
And in the United States as well.
Of course, in the United States, and a lot of the customers come from the United States for this.
Scott Carney's book is called The Red Market, On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. It's published by William Morrow. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. At the beginning of your book, you calculate how much your body would be worth on market given your age, health, and the condition of your teeth, and you come up with a figure of roughly $250,000. Would your value be different if you were, say, a middle-aged Indian woman with no education?
Oh, certainly. And a lot of that has to do with your bargaining ability as well. The middle-aged Indian woman, is at the bottom of the economic totem pole. She really comes from zero bargaining position. So when she, you know, and in right about a kilometer from where I lived in Chennai, 80 women all sold their kidneys within about a year when I was there, and I sort of tracked their story in the book. They're selling their kidneys for $800. If I were going to do it, if I had, you know, with my savvy of having researched this book for a long time, I bet I could get $100,000 for my kidney, which is probably more than I made on the book itself. So maybe there's a different revenue stream for me there.
Well, because you note that American flesh sells at a premium.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned some of the places that are sources for organs. In the book, you talk about the slums of Egypt, South Africa, Brazil, the Philippines as veritable organ farms. Where do they end up? Where do these organs end up? Mostly in Europe and the United States?
Well, no. A lot of the organ trade that's out there is still domestic. So if the kidneys are being sourced in India, most of the customers are in India. For instance, India has one of the highest diabetes rates in the world, and therefore the highest numbers of kidney failure. So a lot of that is in the domestic market. However, it's also exceedingly easy for foreigners to come over there and buy them as well. In fact, there's a hospital in Pakistan I name in the book called Adil Hospital, which advertises packages for Westerners to come in and buy one or even two kidneys if they want, which is, you know, they have one rate for their first kidney and a sort of a discount for their second kidney.
And then do they also perform the operation, the transplant operation?
Yep, they perform the operation. They have their own
one-stop shop.
Yeah, exactly, one-stop shopping for all your kidney needs.
You also investigate a refugee camp for survivors of the 2004 Christmas tsunami called Tsunami Nagar. How many people who lived there sold their kidneys?
Well, when I was there, it was between, 2005 and when I reported it in 2007, 80 women had sold their kidneys, and you could just go there, and you just see all these women with their saris, and the sari sort of bears the midriff. a little bit, and you could just see all of these scars on these women as they go around their daily work. And what made that story international news when I first reported it was that these were tsunami survivors. So you had sort of that 1-2 punch where people were really interested in, you know, the worst sort of environmental disaster, you know, turned into a big organ harvesting scandal. But what is also we need to think about is that this is just one village of dozens around that area which had a very similar situation going on. The Tamil Nadu, which is the state where this happened, the Tamil Nadu transplant committee authorized 2,000 kidney transplants in that time period.
So this is a more desperate version of what we saw a lot in this country over the years when poor people sold their blood just to be able to pay the bills. But you can keep on doing that because your blood replenishes itself. Once you give up a kidney, you can't get it back.
Well, in the United States, it's actually still illegal to sell your blood. What people do is they sell their blood plasma, which is not doesn't have the red blood cells. But to selling whole blood, that actually became illegal, I believe, in 1984. So, yes, you replenish plasma reasonably quickly. I think you can donate 2 times a week. Is that right? With your blood plasma, but you know, just because it can regenerate doesn't mean that there are sometimes problems with these issues. In fact, in the 1950s and 60s, when legal blood sales were going on in the United States, it was actually a major fuel for transmitting bloodborne diseases like hepatitis and later the HIV virus. Because there were these financial incentives given out to people, and they just sold their blood more and more. And all of these blood-buying stations showed up in skid rows around the country. And the documents of that time period say that there were like weevils on the floor and just a cracked wall and just really horrible institutions to increase the American blood supply at the time.
Go ahead.
Oh, and an interesting side note to that, in Kansas City and also in the mid-60s, there was this famous lawsuit between the Red Cross, which operated volunteer blood donation centers, and the commercial blood industry, where doctors realized that the American Cross blood, because it was volunteer-based, was safer than the commercial blood, which came from these sort of skid row areas. And the for-profit blood banks won an FTC lawsuit against the Kansas City hospitals, forcing the Kansas City hospitals to buy the bought blood. They claimed it was unfair trade practices, which is, you know, just a total inversion of what we think of what health should be.
Haven't blood farms been discovered in India, or should I describe some of them as blood prisons?
Yeah, and that was one of the shocking things. Is in India, the blood shortages are even worse than the United States. The U.S. actually exports blood to other countries. It's a several-billion-dollar legal industry. But in India, the blood shortages are pretty bad. There's low donor protocols. And on the Indian-Nepal border about 2 years ago, I found this what can only be called a blood farm, where a dairy farmer would kidnap people from bus stations and lock them in these sort of tin sheds, padlock them in, and then drain their blood about once or twice a week. And some of the people who were there had been held prisoner for 3 years at a time. When it was finally busted, they rescued 17 people who were just drained to a minimal level of consciousness. And this blood bank was supplying a whole bunch of blood to the local market. In fact, when it was shut down, the blood supply of that city called Gorakhpur went down 60%.
Scott Carney is a contributing editor at Wired magazine, and his reporting has also appeared on NPR, CBC, BBC, National Geographic TV, and Mother Jones, Fast Company, Discovery, and Foreign Policy. He's written a book called The Red Market, on the trail of the world's organ brokers, bone thieves, blood farmers, and child traffickers, published by William Morrow. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Scott Carney. His book, The Red Market, on the trail of the world's organ brokers, bone thieves, blood farmers, and Child Traffickers, published by William Morrow. How much medical equipment and training do you need to remove a kidney from someone?
Well, it's not all that much, actually. You need a competent surgeon and a reasonably well-staffed operating room. But some of these surgeries, the illegal ones that were happened in Delhi about 2 years ago, this guy named Amit Kumar, who stole 500 kidneys, literally kidnapping people and taking out their kidneys, he was just in a house, a little concrete building outside of Delhi, and he was able to do it with an operating room, some minimal stuff. The surgical techniques and our surgical skill has come to a point where the surgeries are relatively simple as far as surgeries go. It's the aftercare, which is, you have to be on immunosuppressant drugs basically for the rest of your life after you've had that transplant.
Well, how much money can an Indian kidney be worth? You say that in some cases they sold for very little or even stolen. And do people who sell their kidneys have misgivings about the process?
Well, to sell a kidney, the going rate in India right now is $14,000 for the operation, the buying, the brokering, everything. If a foreigner came there, they'd probably get the sort of the Westerner markup on it. One broker that I had spoken to says that he tries to get foreigners to pay about $80,000 for kidneys, but that's nearly what they think they can get for it. The local price is less. In the Philippines, I believe it's about $6,000 that you can get the kidney transplant for. The people who are selling their kidneys are often in a very difficult position. Most of the people I spoke to actually had serious medical problems in their family, and they were just trying to pay the medical bills for family members. One, a woman named Ronnie, her daughter had tried to commit suicide by drinking pesticides, and she was in the ICU at a Chennai hospital, and the hospital threatened to kick her out before she had been rehabilitated. And Ronnie needed money quickly, so she went immediately to an organ broker, which is about the only way she could raise money reasonably quickly. They gave her an advance of $800, or maybe a little bit more than $800, I think it was $1,400. And she, just to pay her daughter's medical bills. And when you talk to her about this, she says, well, why? Why is it that I need to get taken advantage of by organ brokers? Why do I have to sell my flesh in order to save my daughter? And that's an enduring and important question.
And you note that flesh is often moved up through the social classes, never downward.
Yeah, I've never come across a case where flesh moves downward, where a millionaire donates their kidney and it helps out a poor person in the slum. It may happen, but it's an exceedingly rare case. And it reminds me of this very interesting quote that an activist in Chennai told me. His name was Maria Selvam. He was a local politician, really trying to fight organ traders. And he's watching India become this global economic powerhouse, but he's not seeing his village improved at all. And when I talk to him, he says, in other parts of India, people say that they're going to Malaysia or the United States with a glimmer of hope in their eyes. But in Tsunami Nagar, people speak that way about selling their kidneys. And that really hit me hard when I heard that, because it's really their only hope to see their bodies as this last-ditch social safety net. And it's gross that we've allowed this to happen in the world.
Well, people who are buying a kidney must be aware that someone is being taken advantage of.
I think that a lot of people rationalize it very easily. That when you're told that you are going to die because you have kidney failure, or that you're going to spend the rest of your life on dialysis because you have kidney failure, the first thing that people do is they start looking for ways to get kidneys. And you can't blame them for this. I mean, we all want to save our own lives.
And we have long waiting lists in this country, sometimes up to 5 years for a kidney transplant.
Or 10 years. Yeah, I mean, it's a horrible position to be in. But I think one of the problems with the way we think about kidney failure and organ failure in the United States is that when the doctor tells you that you need a kidney, that you're going to die because your kidneys have failed, they talk about the waiting list. They talk about needing that piece of human flesh to survive. But they don't – it's not as emphasized that you need someone else's kidney. They say, you need a kidney. You don't need to go find someone else to give it up and essentially give up their health for your health and what that means. And I don't think that money and just a purely exchanging currency and our economic power is the moral force to allow that to occur.
On the other hand, people who are waiting a long time for a kidney might die while waiting. So do you see purchasing a kidney overseas as totally unethical?
I think we're entering into one of those long-standing moral debates of what is the value of a human body and even a human soul, if you'll let me go in that direction. I mean, at what point do we sacrifice our own lives for someone else? What is our responsibility to another human being?
Well, they're not sacrificing their lives, except perhaps in China, where prisoners are sometimes operated on while they're I hope people don't get too upset hearing this, while they're still alive as a way of executing them. But but people can live with just one kidney.
Yeah, that's true. People can live with one kidney. But at what point do you draw that line as what your right is over some other person's body? What is really a spare organ? Mm-hmm. Do you think, Leonard, that one of your organs is spare? That would there be any amount of money that someone? I mean, you might give to a family member for certain, but would you give any? If someone came up to you and said, I'm going to give you $1 million for your kidney, would you do it?
No. I agree that sometimes people will give up a kidney out of love to save a family member. But other than that, of course not. But I wonder about the role of governments in all of this. If this sort of practice is being promoted in Bangladesh, you say, and I'm assuming India as well, does the government have any... have any say in this kind of medical tourism?
Oh, certainly. And there are components of organ transplants going on, of commercialized organ transplants all over the place. In India, particularly now, let's move away from kidneys for a second and look at the industry for surrogate labors. That is becoming this just huge economic force in India where Westerners who are priced out of surrogacy in America, which can cost about $100,000, they realize that they can do it for $20,000 in India. So we have hundreds, and perhaps by this year, maybe even thousands of Americans going to India to rent rooms of women. And they keep these women more or less locked up in houses in states like Gujarat and Mumbai and Hyderabad. These are the places where this industry is booming.
How much of the $20,000 goes to the woman who is the surrogate?
Between $5,000 and $8,000, it depends on the complications during pregnancy. If a woman bears twins, they're generally given a little bit extra for that. And there's a push in India right now to conceive of surrogate labor as not just this sort of altruistic thing, this donation thing that they have in the States, but actually protected just like normal labor. It's going to be just like working in a factory. That they'll look at it as a job and look at job protections. And I think that's reasonably creepy to get there.
Well, hasn't Indian surrogacy even been promoted on Oprah's show?
Definitely. And in fact, when that Oprah segment aired in 2007, applications from Americans to India just quadrupled almost literally overnight. Many of the surrogate customers that I spoke to while I was in Anand's Gujarat mentioned that they saw the Oprah segment, and that's when they came. That's when they realized that India was the way to go, both cost effectively and medically. And it's a legal industry; it's reasonably regulated. But what we're doing is we're just looking at Indians for their reproductive value, and we're making these women just sit around and gestate.
Why are so many of these children through surrogate mothers born through C-section?
Well, it's easier. It's more dangerous for the woman involved. It's more dangerous for the child. But, a doctor can schedule it. And when you have, foreigners coming in waiting for a birth, they want to be in Gujarat for as little time as possible. And natural birth, as you know, you can't really depend on an exact date. So the C-section, you can name it right down to the very hour, the very minute that you want to have that baby in your arms.
The Red Market is Scott Carney's book, subtitled On the Trail of the World's Organ Brokers, Bone Thieves, Blood Farmers, and Child Traffickers. You say there's also a booming market in human eggs, and you found that Cyprus is a major source of human eggs. Why Cyprus?
Mm-hmm. Well, Cyprus has a long history of being on the vanguard of fertility treatment. Their fertility clinics in the 80s were in the Guinness Book of World Records for impregnating the oldest woman at that time with in vitro fertilization. And they have the highest number of fertility clinics on that island of any place on the world per capita.
Is there any international oversight for any of these activities?
Oversight?
Does the UN get involved, for example?
No, there is a European... the European Union has some ethical guidelines that state that you're not supposed to pay someone for their eggs, although you can compensate them, and that's a pretty murky definition, murky distinction. But there's no actual enforcement. There's no organization that's going to come in and be able to prosecute anything unless things go absolutely criminal and the police are involved.
Are there free markets?
What happened?
Go ahead.
The Cyprus model is actually somewhat interesting. They do not get their egg donors from local Cypriots. What they do is they'll fly in Ukrainian and Russian women and fly them in for a week or so, harvest the eggs, and then sell those eggs to foreign transplant tourists who come there just for the egg donation. And Cyprus is this sort of netherworld. It's like this meeting point for the egg buyers and the egg sellers to come and have that operation and then just vanish off that island without really good follow-up care for the women who are donating their eggs. And there were some arrests recently for this model where after a woman almost died in a hospital about a year ago, the authorities became very concerned that these systems, these sort of illegally proliferating systems, were just getting out of control, was heating up too much.
You visited a bone factory in India. What was it like, and what is a bone factory?
So if you think about what doctors need to study human anatomy, you'll need a cadaver to sort of cut up and see where the livers and the intestines and the hearts and all that stuff is. But if you want to look at osteology, by the time you've finished cutting up your cadaver, you've more or less wrecked the skeleton. You've sawed it to pieces and it doesn't look so good. So to study human skeletal makeup, you really need a human skeleton that you can study in isolation. And since the 1860s, India has been the number one provider of medical skeletons to the world.
What about the skeletons in classrooms? Are they coming from India, too?
Most of those come from India. At its height, the Indian skeleton industry was exporting 60,000 skeletons every year from its graveyards. That's a huge number, and that was a lot of the people dying in general in Calcutta at that time. And there was no real established way to get skeletons. So what they did, they hired grave robbers, and grave robbers would go around and steal bodies from various sorts of grave sites. And I think there were 11 bone houses at the time, and they exported 60,000 skeletons. Every doctor would buy, every first-year medical student would buy a skeleton for $300 with their sort of introductory textbooks. Now, this practice was made illegal in about 1985 because they found that there was this bone dealer who was caught exporting child skeletons in bulk. I think he was called about 1,500 child skeletons, and there was no way that he could have gotten that number of skeletons, even through grave robbery, so there was the assumption that he was murdering children for the skeletons to sell them.
There's also the issue of medical trials. Do some people make careers about being professional guinea pigs?
And you can make about $60,000 a year running from clinical trial to clinical trial right across the United States. There's actually a sort of informal guinea pig pipeline that goes from Florida all the way up to Seattle, where people will jump from trial to trial. And I actually enrolled in the trial in 2005 for a reformulation of Viagra, where I was locked in a room with 30 guys on these erectile dysfunction pills. And I met a bunch of these professional guinea pigs who, you know, were pretty happy, you know, selling their bodies to these pharmaceutical companies who then would release drugs that would make billions of dollars on the market.
But now a lot of those drug trials have moved overseas. What would a drug tested on a Chinese pharma have tell us about what might happen to an American who's on a completely different diet and has a different lifestyle?
Well, when you look at the broad clinical trials, which are, you know, the most rapidly expanding segment of clinical trials out there, pharmaceutical companies love them for two reasons. One, you can hire a clinical guinea pig for a lot less, and the medical oversight just costs less if you're in China or you are in India or Africa. And number two, a lot of these people that they select have never really had good medical coverage in their life. They've never, you know, they've had very few exposures to antibiotics or to various hypertension medications or anything like that. So they're considered treatment naive, which means that the data that they get isn't influenced by their past history with the pharmaceutical industry. So the data is actually considered much better than the data from America, where you get people traveling from clinical trial to clinical trial with all these experimental compounds in their bodies. However, the oversight in these foreign countries is horrible in most cases. I don't even need to go into what happened in Indian oversight, which is basically non-existent. But if we look at China, there's straight commercial incentives to, you know, more or less exploit some of the people who are most hard hit. There was this instance where a bunch of people who had contracted AIDS because of infected needles with the blood, the commercial blood industry there, they all had AIDS. They weren't, and they had never received treatment by the Chinese government. And pharmaceutical industries would say, great, look at all these really, really sick people who are terminally ill. They're the perfect population for us to test on. So they set up these clinical trials, told them that these injections would cure their AIDS. And, of course, it didn't. It wasn't even going to us for the AIDS vaccine. And then after they did the trial, the trial just left, and all these people died.
We pretty much run out of time, so I can't ask you whether there are free market purists who argue for totally unregulated red markets. But are there?
There are. Indeed.
Okay.
And actually, there's congressional.
I have to leave it there, unfortunately, Scott. Scott Carney, his book, The Red Market, on the trail of the world's organ brokers, bone thieves, blood farmers, and child traffickers. It's published by William Morrow. Thank you so much.